So first of all, it's very antiquated. It's very behind the times compared to other industries on so many levels. The power imbalances are crazy. The sustainability issue is disgusting. Just the abuses of people and forgetting people are human seems to be really, really prolific in this industry. And you know, people in power take advantage of the fact that it's hugely competitive. People are willing to do anything to feel like they're getting into the industry and able to level up in the industry.
Welcome to The Power Hour, the weekly podcast that will motivate you to pursue your passion and to achieve success. I'm Adrienne Herbert, international speaker, fitness coach, Adidas global ambassador and entrepreneur. Each week, I'll be talking to today's leading coaches, creatives, change makers, and innovators to find out their daily habits, morning routines, and rules to live by. The Power Hour is all about taking just 1 hour each day to help you improve your life and unlock your full potential. Whether you want to build a business, write a book, run a marathon, or maybe you're just looking for a spark of inspiration, the Power Hour is going to help you get there faster. Welcome back to the Power Hour podcast. Today's guest is a British fashion designer who launched her first fashion brand at the age of 15. Since then, she has created an incredibly successful technical fashion brand that blends high performance fabrics with high fashion design. The London-based brand has raised a significant investment and has recently entered a commercial partnership with Reebok. She was listed on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list in 2018, and we met back in 2014, 5 years ago, when I walked in her London Fashion Week show. Welcome to the studio, Charlie Cohen.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for writing my new bio.
Yes, you're
amazing.
So welcome.
Thank you.
I mean, it's the shortened version, Charlie. There's been so many incredible things that you've done along the way, and you're so young that it's actually crazy.
Thank you.
It's like you've been in a time zone. But I'd love it for anyone listening who doesn't know much about you, or they maybe just know like the fashion you and your like industry life and your career. Can you please take us pre-fashion school? I know you had an incredible childhood. It's super, super interesting, and I guess has influenced and impacted you and the way you see the world and the things you've been able to achieve and create. So yeah, take us back.
Sure. So I moved around quite a lot as a child, like throughout the UK. And then I spent 2 years sailing with my mum and stepdad to New Zealand in a boat, in a sailing boat that he'd built. So that essentially replaced 2 years of normal school education, probably the best education that I got in my life through the ages of 13 to 14. And spent a lot of time at sea without much to do except write and sketch and figure out what I wanted to do with my life. So it was almost an incubator for figuring out future career, everything that I wanted to do, and also just an amazing way to see the world, experience different cultures, and learn to spend a lot of time socializing with adults. Mm. And then by the time I got to New Zealand and went back into school, it's like I don't actually know how to deal with my peers. So that was quite interesting as well. Mm. And spent 3 years in New Zealand just really struggling to fit in. But I used that time to do other things. So I'm a musician as well. And when I was in New Zealand, I had the amazing opportunity to travel and gig and do festivals singing, which was amazing. And I also got the time to start a bit of formative fashion education. So to study pattern cutting, to study sewing. And the education system was quite poor. So I spent a lot of time basically teaching myself as well, and trying to give myself enough of a grounding to be able to come back to London and go to university there. So it was quite, I'm an only child. I had, I guess, quite an introverted childhood of just like spending a lot of time focusing on doing my own thing and figuring out what I wanted and entertaining myself.
Yeah, that's the thing I was going to pick up from that, actually, what you're describing then, not just from being an only child, but even the idea of being on a boat for 2 years. Like, to me, I can't, the word isolation comes up, but I don't know if you felt isolated and whether you, at that time, were you consuming like media? Were you, you know, like things like now, like social media, and I guess even just the amount of media we consume in a day. And like, people don't spend any time in solitude. They never spend time on their own without other things. So yeah, were you in solitude or not?
So I guess when we left on the boat, the internet was still very much a dial-up modem situation. And there was MySpace, but that was about it. And when we were at sea, obviously there was no internet, no connectivity. We had a satellite phone for emergencies, but like insanely expensive, so it's not like I'd be kind of making calls out to my mates every day. So in that sense it was quite isolating, but then the time that we actually spent on land and in port was probably the most social time of my life, because there's this amazing community of people who are sailing the same route at the same time. So that was a very, very social experience, more so than at any other point in my life, including school, university and everything else. So both extremes, I guess.
Yeah. And then you described when you then went to New Zealand, you felt like you didn't fit in there?
No. So I really struggled in New Zealand. I felt like it wasn't giving me what I needed for kind of how I wanted my career to move forward. I was very, very business oriented from a very young age. I grew up in a very entrepreneurial family, so that was always the way that my mindset was. So it's like, okay, I need X education to be able to get into X university, to be able to start X career path and so on, which obviously I know now is bollocks, but at the time that seemed like the most important thing, and it felt like New Zealand was really limiting me. But in hindsight, New Zealand gave me space to really explore my creativity. I had the time to pursue music. I had the time to gain more training in fashion. And I had the time, probably most importantly, to start my first fashion brand when I was 15, because there was literally the time and space to do that that I probably wouldn't have had in the UK education system.
Yeah, so for sure. And then when you did come to London, as you said, you were driven and seeking that, you know, I want to go to this place. So what was the course that you studied? Where did you study? And talk to us about fashion school.
So I had, first of all, the hardest bloody time getting into fashion school, because I didn't have a like normal A-levels, normal portfolio and so on. So I wasn't able to get onto a foundation course, but I managed to get onto this short course at St. Martin's called Fashion Folio, which was a sort of intensive 2 terms focusing specifically on fashion rather than broader creative. So that kind of became my foundation. And even though a foundation course is generally a prerequisite for getting onto a BA, with that, I was just about able to scramble onto my course at Kingston. And yeah, do my fashion degree there, which I hated, absolutely hated.
Why did you hate it?
It just, I felt very suppressed with what I was able to do. We were put into these industry projects, which really weren't kind of up my street aesthetically. I was very focused on what I wanted. I wanted my own brand. I didn't really want to be designing for like Gap and Banana Republic and French Connection and these other companies that we had these industry briefs for. And I really, really struggled because I was trying to put my own stamp on what I was designing for these briefs, and kept getting shot down by the tutors. And I felt like I spent the whole time trying to mind read as to what people wanted and not really spend much time on what I wanted to get out of this very expensive, very consuming degree. But that, fortunately, all changed in the final year when I was able to focus on doing my own collection. And then suddenly I was able to really turn it all around and ended up graduating as Women's Wear Student of the Year, winning awards at Graduate Fashion Week, and having a pretty amazing time after what felt like the hardest uphill struggle of my life to that up to that point.
Mm. It's so interesting, you know, that that journey, as you describe it, you know, it was so difficult. And I'm sure people, maybe if they're in a situation like that right now, they probably can't see that light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, I think, I mean, what you went on to achieve, I mean, is mind-blowing. So for anyone who doesn't know, that collection that you just described, that's the collection I'm thinking of, right? Which was then photographed. Is that the one?
That was the pre.
Okay, the pre. So you then created a collection which was photographed by Mario Testino for British Vogue.
Yes.
Modelled by Kate Upton. She was on the front cover of Vogue wearing your design, and it was a 4-page spread. And I remember seeing it was across the entire, you know, the Piccadilly Circus.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, it was everywhere. And suddenly, like, that must have been insane to suddenly go, like, who is this designer? She, you know, this is Charlie Cohen. Like, you must have been the cover of British Vogue. How old were you?
So I was 23.
That is crazy. How, like, oh my gosh, talk to me.
Yeah, I mean, that was honestly, the like, in terms of press, that was literally the best thing that could have happened. And it was completely unexpected as well, because it was a very secretive product. I didn't even know what the pieces had been called in for. And we didn't know that they'd been used until it came out. I just know that I got back this pair of leggings. For some reason, they were full of salt water. And when I saw the shoe and saw, like, Kate Upton being photographed in them in the sea, suddenly it all made sense. At the time, it was like, oh, for fuck's sake, like, what have they done to these leggings? And it was like, oh my God, like, take all of my leggings, whatever you want to do to them.
So okay, so someone reached out to you to
yeah, so
take
at that
the product,
point,
but you didn't know why.
I was working with, I'd started working with a PR agency at that point, and the products were called in for Vogue, but we didn't know what the shoot was. And we didn't know that they'd been selected for it, let alone that it was going to be the centerfold and everything else. It's funny because almost every year Vogue sort of reels out that shoot. So I see it again on social media because it's such a...
It's iconic.
It is iconic.
It's an incredible, like, the image is so clear in my mind right now, that image of her, as you say, coming out of the sea. And, you know, I think at the time as well, you know, we're in a different landscape right now with media and kind of showing different kinds of, you know, women, different kinds of bodies, ages, gender, colour, all of that. But at the time, it was almost like people were like, wow, Vogue have stepped away from this idea that every woman on the cover is basically stick thin, that they look a certain way, that they're under 21. Like, it was almost like they were like, wow, look at this rebellious move from Vogue. And I think that brought even more exposure to the partnership and to her cover, let alone the fact that for you, you're like, she's wearing my clothes, guys.
Yeah, no, you're right. It absolutely was very early on in this movement towards better representation and more body positivity. I mean, obviously, like, Kate Upton is gorgeous, but not embodying that traditional, like, size 00 Vogue model that you're used to seeing.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, now Mario Testino has been caught up in Me Too, and that's soured it a bit, you know, now years later. But at the time, it was just the most mind-blowing thing to happen.
Yeah. So what happened next? So what happened next from there? Good, bad, everything in between. What were the next steps?
So next steps, I think for that first 2 to 3 years of the business, I felt very much pressured by the industry to be a certain way, produce a certain thing. So we started off not selling through our website, selling directly through wholesale. So with that, it meant that I produced these collections that spanned from activewear through to ready-to-wear, but stores were just buying activewear. So that was what was getting produced. That's what we were getting known for. And that was quite frustrating because it was only a small fraction of my vision. What I wanted to do was to be able to create non-activewear pieces that were using these technical fabrics. And that became quite frustrating. And maybe in 2016, I got to the point where I was kind of getting sick of designing, and I had to question that, because that was the reason I got into this business. That's my passion. And why is it suddenly feeling like a chore? So at that point, I took a bit of a scary risk to be a little bit like, fuck wholesale, if they don't want to work on our specific terms or work towards my specific vision. and started to design a little bit more of what I wanted and what my original vision had been. And that was, I think, a very transformative moment within the business. Mm. And things started to come together after that. So at the end of 2017, we signed this big deal with Reebok, which is launching in March next year.
Congratulations.
But there's going to be a little something pre coming out in November of this year, which is very exciting. And since then, we have launched Shades of Blue, which is a mental health platform looking specifically at issues within the creative industry. Mm-hmm. Very much inspired by my own personal experience in the creative industry. Yeah. And those people that I've spoken to. We've ended up working so much with musicians because we're creating this technical product that's actually perfect for stage performances, mm-hmm. that we've now launched this production company for music industry where we create music videos, create promotional content and do costume and styling and merch. And it's kind of a one-stop shop. Mm. And it's so close to, well, I think it's so perfectly what I wanted the brand to become and so far from what it was becoming through those first 2 to 3 years.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting how it's in a way transitioned, but also not transitioned, because as you said, that was your initial kind of vision for the brand in the first place. But I want to go back a bit because I'm listening to you talk and I'm like,
jumping ahead.
It's just the fact that your journey, like to you and maybe to me, because I know you, you know, it's kind of like, oh yeah, of course I did this. And of course I was like, oh, I'm going to do it my way. And of course I had to be true to who I am, but people find that incredibly difficult. And, you know, it seems to me that throughout your entire life, you've always, I guess, just been so, you know who you are, but also you've been brave. You've been able to kind of say, you take risks. You're not risk averse. Do you know what I mean? Like, these are big risks. And people often, you know, that people encourage now, like, get out of your comfort zone. Like, I don't think you have a comfort zone. Like, you don't, like, how have you, would you agree? And also, where do you think that comes from? Is that just innate in you?
It's strange because I guess I'm quite an anxious person as well, but I'm also very decisive and I have honed my gut instinct or got better at trusting my gut instinct because I've taken, you know, X number of smaller risks that have paid off, and then you can kind of get more and more daring with what you do. I think definitely my family, again, seeing them run their own businesses, taking a lot of risks, seeing them paying off has helped, you know, that's the kind of proof of concept for me. And that was the environment that I was raised in.
I guess even like the moving and the traveling, and, you know, you mentioned you traveled and your mum like sold and bought houses. And you, do you think that also made you braver because there wasn't this kind of idea of like a constant and the fact that you have to do one thing one way? I guess you probably, I don't know, did you ever see that, you know, for a lot of people, they're just shown one way. That is life, that way, that's it.
I think that definitely played a huge part. I've never been really settled anywhere and I've never wanted to be. I'm all about optionality. I want to always know that there are these different things I can be doing. I would find it quite claustrophobic to think I'm just kind of stuck in this one spot doing this one thing. So I'm always pushing to evolve because that's how I get my kicks. But I would say I'm not risk averse, but the anxiety is almost quite helpful in that it means that I really weigh up the pros and cons as much as I can. There's obviously a large level of unknown, but there are also practical, logical things that you can weigh up to then base that gut instinct off.
Mm. And would you, because again, knowing you personally, I would describe you as an introvert. However, I think for people who just look at your list of achievements and the fact that you're incredibly young and, you know, even the fashion industry and, you know, being on social media and other forms of media, I often think that people assume that extroverts thrive in that world and that environment and introverts don't. Or people who are introverts themselves might say, well, I could never do this, or I could never do that. So sure. how have you done that? Because would you agree that you are an introvert?
I am introverted. I see myself as being pretty socially awkward and shy and always have been. I mean, that's one of the reasons that I've always been quite focused on doing my own little thing. So one of the things that's really helped me has been rather than looking at networking in, I guess, the stereotypical way, like you go to these parties and these events, which is my worst nightmare.
Fashion parties.
Exactly. Fashion parties. Yeah. Just, I don't drink either. So like there's no way of taking the edge off the hell that is a fashion party. The best way I've found has been to work with and collaborate with the people that I want to get to know. And being able to get to know them in that environment, which is very natural to me, where I feel confident and in control. And that has been hugely helpful. And, you know, meeting people through that, then they introduce me to other people who I also work with. And it's been, I think, a much more effective way of networking than just trying to be on this scene.
Mm-hmm. So collaboration.
Collaboration, exactly. Yeah. Which, you know, being in the creative industry, there's so much scope to be able to work with these people. So, you know, reaching out in a way that I'm more comfortable with via social media or via email, where I don't need to do like the scary face-to-face bit straight off the bat, and then work up to that. Get the coffee, do the project.
Yeah, because I know that you've talked very openly, honestly, online about your own mental health struggles and about anxiety. And I don't know, I feel like you have a love-hate relationship with fashion and the fashion industry specifically.
Yes, yeah. So one of the primary motivations for starting Charlie Cohen and also how it's evolved has been my discomfort with the fashion industry. So I'm trying to come in as this sort of quiet anarchist to fuck things up a little bit. So first of all, it's very antiquated. It's very behind the times compared to other industries on so many levels. The power imbalances are crazy. The sustainability issue is disgusting. Just the abuses of people and forgetting people are human seems to be really, really prolific in this industry. And, you know, people in power take advantage of the fact that it's hugely competitive. People are willing to do anything to feel like they're getting into the industry and able to level up in the industry. It's just a nasty, toxic environment that, first of all, attracts people. Generally, creative industries attract people with mental health issues because creativity is an outlet for those people. And then it puts them in an environment that is the worst possible environment for somebody who's anxious or depressed or dealing with any type of mental health issue. Mm. And then it kind of glamorizes it as well, because there's this idea of the tortured artist and, you know, creating from the darkest depths of your, you know, fears and insecurities and so on. And, you know, it's been in the media over the last few years, the number of suicides in the industry from people who on the surface seem to be doing so well, and let alone all those people that nobody knows about, who didn't get to that level of fame. And that's something that I've been looking at for the however many years that I've been involved in this industry. Whilst I was at uni, seeing my friends go into these horrible internships where they were, you know, really poorly treated.
And probably not paid for.
Yeah, definitely not paid for.
Working for free 24 hours a day.
Working for free, like literally 24 hours a day. And I thought, okay, I can either complain about this from the outside, or I can try and change it in my own little way from my own little corner on the inside. So that's essentially what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to create positive change and subvert all of those like horror stories of the industry, and at least be an example of a way forward.
Yeah, well, you're doing an incredible job, and I guess for anyone as well who works with you, or who, you know, I guess it kind of shows that there's other ways to create and to be in the industry and to succeed as well. Because
sure.
I think that's what it comes down to. Maybe ultimately, as you said, with these things being glamorized and being kind of part of the job, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, this is the only way. If you want success in this business, it's that kind of thing. It's like, how much are you willing to pay and all of that?
Exactly. And it's being gatekept by people who've gone through this, what they perceived to be a rite of passage, which is actually just abuse. And then they think like, okay, anybody coming up needs to go through the same abuse. Earn your stripes.
At any cost.
At any cost, which is ridiculous. Mm. It's so unnecessary. And it's so old school
and terrifying. Do you think that I mean, now with obviously social media and the way that kind of our all these industries are kind of being exposed and people's voices are coming, you know, being democratized, do you think that it is it changing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's still a long way to go, but there is a platform now, first of all, for people to get their name out there and showcase their talent without having to go through these traditional industry paths, to be able to call out abuses in the industry. That's huge. There's now a little bit of fear instilled in these people who were the abusers. Now mm-hmm. that, you know, they're aware that there could be a whistleblower out there.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole Me Too movement is an example of that, which is great. It's great that there's fear in that part of the industry now, mm. That they think twice about the way they're behaving. But I think, you know, importantly, through social media, people are seeing others that they can relate to that look like them, that have grown up in the same way that they have, that are succeeding in their own way in the industry. And suddenly they have a role model that isn't just a middle-class skinny white girl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is, you know, that's so transformative. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the most amazing things that social media has been able to bring to the table.
For sure. It's very, very powerful. So one of the projects that I've actually seen that you were a part of was the Daisy app, the class of 2019.
Yes.
So you were photographed by Rankin alongside a host of amazing creatives. I can't name them all, but there was, I was looking at that picture and it just, everybody was there. And I read a quote that you said then that said, "Creativity means being able to put my own perspective on the world around me and translate it into a product." Which is, I think, just sums up exactly what you do. So, talk to us about the Daisy app, the project, and being a part of that, and also hanging out with Maisie Williams.
First of all, Maisie is awesome. She's absolutely as lovely and down to earth as she comes across. It was crazy to be part of that project. I mean, to be shot by Rankin, and I didn't even know we were going to have individual shots with Rankin until the day. I thought it was just this group situation. So that was both amazing and terrifying. Rankin also very lovely.
This is great to hear. Countering the last 5 minutes of the chat,
And it was really funny, actually, slightly embarrassing that he was like, "Oh, you have amazing hair. We have to get you a wind machine." I was the only person there who had a sodding wind machine.
The girl who hates fashion is at the fashion shoot with Rankin with a wind machine. She was like, "The slight irony of this."
Had my wind machine. Got to meet lots of cool people. I mean, the premise of Daisy is really awesome. Like, very much about democratizing the industry, giving people at different levels within the industry the opportunity to collaborate and learn from each other, which is very cool.
So this is on an app, so can anybody download the app?
Anybody can download the app or join via the desktop website. Basically, you're able to either create projects or join projects, and it's all about collaboration, portfolio building, being able to network and meet people and work with people in the way that I was talking about earlier. It takes away a lot of the barriers to creative collaboration across industries, which is very cool.
Amazing. And also, I guess it makes it safer, because one thing that I remember way back when I was like, how old? I mean, I'm old now, but I'm thinking back to when I was maybe 17, 18, 19. And at the time I was living in London, I was a professional dancer. I think I was with maybe two agencies and a commercial modeling agency. And I remember then, I mean, I didn't have Instagram then, thank goodness, but I do remember receiving messages from guys that were like, "I'm a photographer, let's do a shoot."
Yeah.
Like, "I can give you a portfolio that you can then use, and I can keep all the pictures." And I think when you're young, you're like, "Great, like, there's a photographer in London that like wants to take photos of me, and I can use this as a portfolio." And I think that actually I do like to think I had my head screwed on, and I'd always, you know, kind of question these things and almost look, do they have a portfolio of work? Do this person have a website? You know, like, is this safe? Because I think often when young people are going into an industry that's creative and they might want to collaborate, they might see opportunities and think like, oh, this is great.
When actually you want to say yes to every opportunity, right?
Yeah, and actually those situations can be dangerous, but also very kind of, there's vulnerable people who can end up like being photographed nude in black and white, which I definitely know the friends did. And then they were told like, oh, you know, it's like, where are those pictures going to be used?
Yeah, I mean, it's the era of model mayhem. And yeah,
crazy. So I guess it's great that also these kind of platforms exist to ensure, yeah, safety.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is awesome. Okay. Oh my gosh, there's so many things I want to talk to you, Charlie. It's just like wisdom. So if you could give the listeners, I guess, maybe let's go with two things. One, like something you wish you'd known, say, I don't know, I don't want to say how long ago, but like back in the day. Do you know what I mean? Something that you've maybe had to learn the hard way that you wish you could go back and tell yourself. What would that be?
I wish that I had been better at trusting my gut earlier on. I think that has held me back and delayed things more than they could have been delayed. Just to trust my own instincts. One of the challenges that I've found in industry is not just that everybody wants to input, and they really do, especially in fashion. Everybody feels like they know about fashion. They want to have a say. But one of the struggles is that you would think that people who've spent 20, 30 years in industry would absolutely have the wisdom. You should absolutely take their advice as gospel. And the issue is that 20, 30 years ago, or for the last 20, 30 years, the industry has been very different to how it is now. So in those situations, I wish I'd known that actually, in some circumstances, I maybe had a better read on what was coming up next and where to go than these people who were stuck in this old way of thinking. I think just the trust in my own instincts, my own decisions, which is something that I guess I've only learned through proving to myself time and time again that I've been kind of on the right track.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it's really interesting to hear that, especially for, say, for example, young people who intern, you know, in big brands or corporations or whatever, where the decision makers might be those people that you're describing. You know, they've been there a long time and things have changed. And often I think I encourage people, I'm like, people don't know what you know unless you tell them. So for example, you know, saying to someone, like having ideas and being like, I think we should be doing this because this is what's happening online, or this is, you know, the next generation, or the next kind of, you know, I don't know, the next generation of consumers and their purchase power and their habits. Like I, you know, pushing that forwards and being like, I know this stuff. Like, listen to me. Yes, I might be 21 or yes, I might be 25, but don't kind of
dismiss me.
Yeah. I think older, I think, and also in reverse, I think people need to listen to the younger people in their team or in their family or in their network to kind of seek that information too.
Sure, and then it's finding the middle ground between the learned years of experience and that on the ground instinctive knowledge of what's happening. Mm.
Yeah, I think both need to kind of, learn from one another. And then my second question for you, I guess today I mean, there's so many things. I've highlighted, you know, your successes, your, you know, your ambition, your kind of just amazingness, just all round CC-ness, the vibe. It's inspiring.
Thank you for the hype.
But it's true because I've known you for so long and it's never changed. That's the thing. You've never changed. You've never, you know, it's never been diluted. You've never gone like, oh, I'm just going to do this thing for like a quick, you know, mainstream. Like, you've just always stayed CC, which I think is hugely admirable. But my question to you is, there must have been some failures. It's not all been success. And there must have been some like real challenges and lows. So, yeah, I guess the question is, can you think of a particular failure or low where you've thought there's no coming back from this, or I don't want to come back from this, or, you know, it's all over, but here you are still? Because I think sometimes people, they'll hear someone go, oh, of course I have failures, and they'll name like a tiny thing, but they're like, this is make or break time, but you're still here.
I think the biggest thing was spending so long trying to guess at what the industry wanted rather than thinking about what I wanted. And I spent 3 years moving further and further away from my vision. And at the end of that, I hated what I was doing. And it, you know, it wasn't representing anything close to what I wanted, which was soul destroying, because I put in 3 years hard, hard grind to get further away from what I'd done with my graduate collection, which was ridiculous. So I think that really was the biggest thing, like spending such a long time ignoring my own vision.
Yeah.
Well, even within my own company, where I was technically the one making all the decisions, I was still absolutely a puppet of the industry. Even though I was aware that I disliked the industry, I was still using their benchmarks of success rather than my own benchmarks of success.
Wow. And how did you turn that around? And what would you say is your benchmark for success now?
I'm still trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
It's tricky when you're trying to create a new model and there isn't a precedent. So I think benchmark is really every day just feeling like I'm executing my vision and proud of what I'm doing. That's as much as I can do for now in terms of benchmarks. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm quite a decisive person. It was very much probably a 24-hour, like, this is ridiculous. These are the ways that it needs to change. First of all, we need to go seasonless. I don't want to be fitting into the stupid industry timeline. I need to find ways to be both more environmentally and more financially sustainable as a business, which again, the industry, the luxury fashion industry, isn't suited to if I'm following their rules. And I need to be working directly with my customer rather than through this proxy that is wholesale. Kind of figured out the changes that I could make right away, made those, made a plan for the changes that would take longer or take more fundraising to be able to achieve, and just got on with it.
Yeah, I love that, because with everything you do, it's always like solution based. You know, the people that just find problems and excuses or reasons and they put off, whereas I think with you, it's always solutions.
Like, I like to fix things.
Yeah, give me a problem, fine, solution. Awesome. Okay, Charlie, I want to talk to you about the Power Hour. So I want to talk about what gets you out of bed in the morning, what makes you excited, inspired, any daily hacks that you have, any things you've created into your routine. And yeah, I guess as a creative, I don't know what time you get up, but I want to know all of it. So what time and what's the first hour of your day like?
Okay, so what literally gets me out of bed in the morning are our two dogs.
Yes, so cute.
So that is really a 7 a.m. situation, whether I like it or not.
Okay.
So that's kind of the day starts. So one Pomeranian, one Maltipoo, and she's 6 months, so she's like,
wow,
very demanding at 7 a.m. So I think if the dogs weren't waking me up, I would either wake up at 4 a.m. or 10 a.m., depending on level of jet lag and whatever else. But the most important part of my somewhat unstructured morning routine is to have a couple of hours before I need to deal with people and the outside world. So I will always make sure that sort of meetings don't start until after 11-ish, so that I have that space in the morning to do whatever I need to do. I try to leave it as long as I can before picking up my phone. Usually I can make it about an hour of not picking up the phone, which definitely helps with headspace for the rest of the day. And I try to get something, however small, ticked off my to-do list within those first couple of hours of the morning, because that suddenly makes the whole rest of the day seem easier, and really helps to reduce anxiety for me, knowing that I've made that one little commitment to whatever my day's tasks are. Mm-hmm. And that is really the only areas that are consistent,
mm-hmm, okay,
in the morning routine. I do meditate every day. I can't always do it in the morning, some point in the day. Mm-hmm. I will do that. The most important thing about mornings for me is creating space, and then it changes from day to day as to what I fill that space with, but I need to know that it's there.
Yeah, I like that, having that white space available to you instead of it being filled by someone else. I said to someone the other day that, like, if you don't claim your time, then someone else will. They'll fill that space. So as you said, if you say to people, I'm available from 9 a.m., you're going to be you know, needed from 9 a.m. Whereas exactly. if you say as a creative person, you know, like, oh, actually, I'm available from midday, then people will respect and work around that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think as well, I deal a lot with the US. So I'm working on New York time and LA time. And that means working later into the evenings. So it's important to have that, you know, to be starting later in the day. So I'm not working or switched on for ridiculous hours. And that's something that I learned the hard way as well. I had really severe burnout a couple of years into the business and basically had to learn how to run my business and run my day with a couple of hours where I had the energy to be productive.
Yeah.
And those habits have stuck, you know, and as grim as it was at the time, it's probably the best thing that's happened to me as a business person in terms of how I'm now able to structure my day and build in, as you described it, the white space. It's so important.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to talk about that in a way that's positive, because I think often, you know, I've read a lot of stuff about, you know, you are incredibly successful and you are a high achiever and a high performer, and I think often people describe those people in one bracket as, and I think people put me, they think that I'm in the camp of like, you have to get up early, you have to read this many books a month, you have to be productive, everything has to be about execution and about, you know, bigger and better and goals, and if you're not doing this, you're not doing anything. And it's kind of ironic for me because I'm an ambitious person, I want people to achieve success, whatever that looks like for them. But I know there's different ways to do that. And I think that often people don't, they just show one way, you know, it's like hustle and grind, early morning, late night, like whatever it takes, like that's the only way. Because if you're not doing it, other people will outwork you, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I think there is that lack of understanding that there's a difference between being busy and being productive. And filling all the hours of the day doesn't mean you're productive. In fact, it's probably going to reduce your productivity. Whereas, you know, you can do the hustle and grind supported by having done the self-care, having had the headspace for your subconscious to figure stuff out. I mean, you know, we're talking about problem solving. All the biggest ideas that I've had for the business, all the biggest changes that I've had for the business have come to me during those times of space that I've created for myself. Because if I'm just having meetings and doing stuff all the time, there's no time for my brain to actually work out the really fundamental important things for the business.
Yeah, for sure. So on that note, could you give the listeners a challenge, something that maybe, so the Power Hour challenge each week, I just want us to get an idea or an insight or an inspiration to try something new, because it's great to listen to this show and it's great when people tell me, you know, oh, this really motivates me, or, you know, I really enjoyed that conversation. I'm like, brilliant. But I think action and like implementing action and change is kind of more important than, you know, than just listening, feeling inspired, and then that's it. So do you have a challenge for the listeners, something that we could try this week to maybe, yeah, challenge ourselves?
Yeah, so the next time that you're feeling overwhelmed, that you have so much to do, actually stop what you're doing, go out and have a walk for an hour. See what that does for you.
Yeah, because it kind of feels opposite of what you want to do.
But it feels wrong. It feels, there's like a guilt thing around it. But yeah, just stop, take the hour, go for a walk, and I think you'll be surprised at how you feel when you come back, and maybe how much of this stuff that you feel that you need to be working on you've actually managed to work through in a calm way.
Yeah, awesome, thank you. Okay, and before I ask you my last question, can you tell us all where we can find you online and also where we can shop CC online?
Yeah, so I think the easiest thing is to come to our Instagram, which is at Charlie Cohen, and that's Charlie spelled really annoyingly awkwardly, C-H-A-R-L-I Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. And that really has kind of all the elements of the brand world, and you can go through to our website from there.
Awesome, brilliant. And so my closing question for you, Charlie, is all about time. I ask everyone this question, and I love this answer every time. So it's all about time. I think it's the most valuable thing we have. You can get your money back, but you can never get your time back.
Very true.
So what is the most valuable thing that time has taught you?
I think time has taught me that within my business, my health and ability to work is the most important thing. So if I'm prioritizing the grind over my own self-care, the business can't succeed.
Brilliant. Absolutely. Wonderful advice. I would expect nothing less.
Thank you.
No, thank you. I've loved having you today.
Oh, it's been a joy to talk to you. And Thank you for making me feel so great about myself.
Always. I think that's my gift in life, is to make
seriously,
hype people.
Seriously,
I'm a professional hype
you are
woman.
The best hype woman.
Yeah, I love doing it. So thanks for coming in. And I really hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope that... that you got some insight from that, regardless of whether you're interested in fashion or whether you hate fashion, as I think Charlie does.
Yeah, so it's okay to be both.
Yeah, you can do both. Thanks so much, Charlie. Remember to rate and review this episode on iTunes, tag us in your stories, follow at Charlie Cohen online, and have an awesome week. See ya.
Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.